Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this week's Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up, we'll talk Costco, Stitch Fix as well, releasing their fourth quarter earnings, and a two-in-one story with Barnes & Noble and Mattress Firm both appearing somewhat distressed. The latter we've known about for a while. The former, new information is coming to light. And we're looking ahead concerning the new JCPenney CEO. We're brought to you this week by AdRoll.com, which helps ambitious brands orchestrate social ads, email, and other marketing channels to drum up more revenue. Also brought to you by Blinkist, an app that distills the key insights of 2,500-plus best-selling nonfiction books into powerful 15-minute reads or listens. As always, please rate us wherever you listen. Really helps us out, and plus it gives us a nice warm feeling inside, the likes of which, that warm feeling, wasn't felt by Costco investors this week, as Costco's latest quarterly earnings report was for their fiscal fourth quarter, which is historically their largest, but shares fell over 5% after reporting on Thursday. Costco reported fourth quarter sales of $43.4 billion, which was 5% greater than last year. These were sales that excluded membership income, too. Now, e-commerce sales were up double digits, around 26%, which is good. We've mentioned struggled at times in the past with e-commerce, seemed to be picking it up now with these double-digit percentage increases. E-commerce, by the way, for them, up 32% for the full year. But Leighton, the problem is e-commerce doesn't represent a substantial number of total revenues. And honestly, earnings elsewhere disappointed investors a little bit, even if they were still very, very good for the retailer overall.
Yeah, this is a retailer that we love to talk about. One, because it's a wholesale club. And two, Costco is sort of a bellwether for the retail industry. So we'd like to talk about brick and mortar on this podcast. But e-commerce, like you mentioned, still only representing 4% of total revenues, which some have looked at as a problem in the recent past. But we've actually taken a glass half full approach with their e-commerce business, because really you should look at this as an opportunity in progress for Costco and Costco management in particular. One reason being that Costco can look at e-commerce and try to take what they've already done in terms of slowly building out their platform and seeing what works and what doesn't. This is a pragmatic approach, and we think this is one that's going to suit Costco very well. As long as their e-commerce division can maintain profitability and maintain a certain level of presence throughout the retail industry, it's going to be a positive in the long term. They also want to make sure that those who visit the website are usually going to be within 100 miles of a physical location. And a lot of people may think that's odd because it's counterintuitive to having an e-commerce business. The idea being that a lot of rural customers can't often make the trip, or it's just simply too far, or you're not in a market that currently has a Costco. But this sort of makes sense because they actually want to be able to leverage their e-commerce site to draw people into the physical stores to keep up U.S. comps. And those U.S. comps were up 7.8% for the latest quarter. This is without fuel. With fuel, up 9.5%. You have to factor in the with and without fuel and why retailers often leave out fuel with these comps. Reason being here is we've seen a lot of inflation for gasoline. Gasoline prices are going up. Therefore, those prices, whether the volume is up or not, it's usually going to trickle down to the top line. Adjusted for 1 week less as well are U.S. comp stores. In the fourth quarter of last year, they had one additional week to report on. Traffic was up by nearly the same percentage as those comp sales. So this is really good, Trent. This means that customers are seemingly having more money to spend at each individual store. So customers have more money, as we've been talking about with wages. And this has a trickle-down effect in particular for retail or big box retail, where customers are able to spend more on groceries. They crossed the $1 billion line for quarterly profits this quarter, which were up 13.5% versus last year's fourth quarter. $1.043 billion was brought in on the bottom line. Earnings per share was up, but not by as much as the absolute net income number. Earnings per share ticked up to $2.36 per share, which missed analyst expectations by around 4 cents per share.
One of the big reasons why that stock dropped last week, and analysts, despite the stock drop, liked what they heard from Costco, despite there being internal control problems on their financial reporting systems. Potential security flaws had been identified, but no breaches had been reported. This was formally identified as a material weakness. Their IT and financial systems were apparently vulnerable for a period of time. The fact that the company is mentioning it may have to do with SEC disclosure, but may also work to soften the blow a little bit if they do report that a breach did in fact happen sometime in the future. So it can help to mitigate that potential hit. What is interesting is the company's 10K went on to say that their remediation efforts are underway but may not be completed on the IT side until close to the end of fiscal 2019. So this is a story that's not only something to keep an eye on for the next couple of months, but well on into next year. And this is something you would like to see get done sooner rather than later. As we've seen with Target and other retailers, security vulnerabilities do have lasting impact, even though in Costco's case, this isn't customer-facing still. They get a lot of negative publicity from it, and that could potentially drive traffic down like it did with Target, although Target had many other things that kind of drove traffic to go slightly south in 2015 and 2016. Now back to Costco. In their U.S. and Canada stores, membership renewal rate for the fourth quarter stood at 90.4%. That is up sequentially from 90.1% in the third quarter. Their total global renewal rate was 87.9%, so higher in North America than it is globally, but we do expect this renewal number to be lower in markets where they have limited size and experience, not like the US and Canada where experience is ample with Costco. And as we'll note in a bit, some countries only have a handful of stores, so it's easier for them to move the meter up or down one way or the other when they're included in metrics.
When we talk about the top line and what has helped the top line for Costco, we're going to look at the absolute number of cardholders now for the company. They ended the year with 94.3 million people having a Costco membership. This is up from 93 million last year. A lot of this is a function of new stores. During the quarter, Costco had 13 net new openings. They had 15 in the last quarter, in the fourth quarter of last year, for reference. They are getting consistent numbers of upgrades to their executive membership, their highest level of membership that costs a lot of money if you're just coming into the membership club for the first time. And if you look over the last four quarters or so, you can see that they're getting consistent numbers of upgrades to their executive membership, their highest priced membership across the previous four quarters. You see that there has been sequential growth with getting people to either go from a business membership or a regular membership to the executive membership. Total membership income, by the way, was up $44 million to almost $1 billion for the quarter, $997 million to be exact. Keep in mind, renewals and add-ons are now getting charged that higher membership rate that we had reported on. Something to keep an eye on now that people are going to be heading into renewal season over the next two quarters and perhaps decide to exit the Costco membership altogether because of the expense of that membership. However, Trent just talked about the renewal rate. We're curious to see if that stays online. If it does, that membership income goes straight to the bottom line. They've recently bumped up their base wage, by the way. Base wage went from around $13.50 an hour to now $14 an hour for those hourly associates. And this started in June. This has actually hurt their SG&A. Reportedly, management is still pretty bullish on their overall methodology here. They love paying their workers a fair hourly wage. They feel as though there's a lot of positive benefits surrounding a good hourly wage. Right now, for the company, executives said the hourly average wage is right around $22.50. Certainly one of the highest in terms of established retailers here domestically, and something they are proud of. Again, Amazon, of course, just announced a $15 an hour base wage, which delighted many of their warehouse employees. There's actually some viral videos out there of people celebrating in their distribution centers. Further evidence that the federal government may not need to intervene with the federal minimum wage hike, and states and companies really trying to compete for workers, so they're having their own hourly wage minimums raised up a little bit more aggressively throughout different municipalities as well. Gross margins did shrink ever so slightly on food and hardlines categories, something we think will actually continue as inflation ticks up in this country. But the retailers are going to be lagging behind the curve in terms of increasing the pricing for the core customer due to competition. This is something you hear a lot. There is usually a trickle-down effect, but there is a period of lagging. So Honestly, consumers are certainly going to be the beneficiaries of a tight grocery market. And in this case, Costco is a massive seller of groceries. Compressed margins is something we have seen from Walmart, where pricing is fairly low and has helped to boost store sales to all-time highs. You see their grocery and produce sections doing extremely well with Walmart. During this fourth quarter Q&A session, management did mention at Costco that gross margin or core gross margin compression is okay. They are fine with it. They can sleep well knowing that compression is going to happen. It's going to be a mainstay for the company in the near term. They said as a result, they have to look, and every 4 weeks they look at how they do from audit data from all of their competitors in terms of comparison pricing metrics. They say that it's okay that they have tightened gross margins because they are still highly competitive on price, and they feel as though as long as they can have the lowest prices, in particular the grocery and hardline segments, that they will be bringing in adequate levels of traffic, and therefore that is inherently good for their business. They said that they feel very confident about where they sit in all 8 geographical locations throughout the U.S. in terms of competitive price points.
Now, overall, the input costs of fuel, IT, and expenses related to Hurricane Harvey all played a part in the SG&A basis point decline that Leighton referenced. For the full fiscal year, changing our gears somewhat to real estate and the number of stores they have opened, they opened 21 stores over the last fiscal year and had 4 relocations. Now, the question of future growth is always tied to Costco. There's a lot of people out there that think the runway for expansion now is limited in the U.S. After all, we are talking about membership clubs here. Usually, even in large to mid-size markets, there's limited room for expansion to membership clubs. And also, real estate runs out. These stores are very big between Sam's Club and Costco, and it's sometimes difficult to find a working location for them. However, Costco is expected to open the same amount of new stores in fiscal 2019, if not a couple more. 4 relocations also for this upcoming year planned. And Costco ended its 2018 fiscal year with 762 warehouses in operation, including 527 of those in the United States and Puerto Rico, 100 in Canada, 39 in Mexico, another 28 in the UK, 26 in Japan, 15 in Korea, 13 in Taiwan, 10 in Australia, and in case you are wondering, another 2 in Spain, 1 in France, and 1 all the way up in Iceland. Costco also operates e-commerce websites in the U.S., Canada, and the U.K., as well as Mexico, Korea, and Taiwan. Now, we mentioned some of those numbers. Obviously, the big number, 527 in the United States, 100 in Canada. Leighton and I have often discussed the fact that we feel like there's probably a cap, maybe a soft cap, of 600 to 650 Costco stores in the U.S. They're slowly building towards that. Hard to think that there's going to be too much upper space there in terms of the ceiling for Costco in terms of membership club growth with locations. One of the things they are looking to expand in beyond just real estate, though, e-commerce product selection in the coming years. For this most recent quarter, management said they only expanded assortment slightly, and the delivery partnerships with Shipt and Instacart, so far, at least per management, are going well. These services, of course, are concerned more with grocery items, the Shipt partnership being a particularly odd one because Target bought Shipt for $550 million less than a year ago. They're really a direct competitor with access to at least some data. Although they're not in the membership club segment, they're still servicing a lot of the same customers. As far as Costco is concerned, away from those partnerships and Shipt and Instacart, conversion on their site, bottom line, it's seen improvement. Not only are they focused on growing their core business with brick and mortar, but also looking to add to that e-commerce effort. And it's a good thing that conversion is up because once again, 4 years ago even, this was known as a company that would all but ignore e-commerce. So this is a way to basically organically boost their bottom line. Not only are they focused on these things, but they're adding value to shareholders as well by buying back stock. They bought back 419,000 shares in the fourth quarter and over 1.7 million shares in all of fiscal 2018. So Leighton, we've gone through all of this information, all of this good news here. Why was the stock down?
Yeah, and besides the earnings per share number that you had mentioned earlier, you really have to wonder why was the stock down? This was actually the largest drop in the share price in over a year. I believe the first week of October last year, it fell by a pretty big drop, but this really speaks to the staying power in general of the stock and the idea that it tends to be a little less volatile overall. It's sort of, like I said at the beginning of the story, a retail bellwether for the United States. But beyond the IT issues that Trent had discussed with the financial reporting, the company has ties to a lot of countries overseas in which they source a lot of their product. This is, and always has been, inherent to their business model. Buy low, sell high. Same sort of thing that Walmart has done for so very long. However, Walmart is actually changing their strategic buying, and they're looking towards American companies. So they're pointing their buyers towards American companies that source products that are made and manufactured inside the United States. Costco still imports much of its non-food related categories from countries that are in the midst of tariff speculation. So this could be a reason that the stock is down. There has been more volatility in the stock market overall. We talk about companies that are deep into agriculture, deep into metal sourcing. All of those companies have been hit through tariff speculation across the last few months. The gross margins for the company, also a problem. They've already been compressing, as we've already noted, but this could get worse if the cost of goods goes up even more. Again, we're talking about sourcing certain products, and the cost of those could go up because the manufacturers are trying to press down and pass on the price increases that they could be getting from potential tariffs. Again, a lot of metal is sourced from China. If China has tariffs imposed, you could see a lot of compression in that particular business, and therefore costs rising for Costco's consumer, combined with domestic labor and rising fuel costs. This may be a business that sees much larger revenue growth relative to earnings growth in the latter half of fiscal 2019. So overall, what I'm saying here is that earnings per share could dwindle down to a number where analysts are not really looking at this as a company deserving of its current multiple. Still, experienced analysts have noted that Costco's stock price does tend to wane after earnings calls, and overall, about one half of the time, there is a pullback in the stock. And there was one analyst out there that wrote an article suggesting that with this particular pullback, that people should buy on this, and that for the long term, Costco's pullbacks are usually temporary and the stock has nowhere to go but up. Again, this is speculation from one analyst out there on the web. There are so many out there giving their own opinion. And granted, a pullback is 100% a relative term too, because the shares were recently trading at all-time highs in September, so it's all relative. We see the price of a single share recently rising above $240. Shares ended last Friday around $218 a share, still leaving it up from around the $188 mark that was seen at the beginning of this calendar year. So January 2nd, a price of one share of Costco stock was $188. Not a bad run-up. Still, some companies are doing better, but Costco is certainly one of those companies that has staying power. And that dividend yield, by the way, it has shrunk down to about 1% thanks to that capital gains run-up.
Now, we just gave you a lot of stats about Costco. Here's an interesting stat, though. 88% of financially successful people read at least 30 minutes per day. And heck, Leighton and I aren't even financially successful, and we still read 30 minutes per day. Financially successful people are hungry for knowledge. They continuously seek self-improvement and learning every chance they get. And Blinkist gets you there faster than you can imagine. And look, if you're like me, the list of books you want to read or the list of books that people suggest you read is never ending and always expanding. Look, you simply just don't have time to read them all. Our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all.
Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all from your phone. We all have our phone on our person at all times. With Blinkist, you will expand your knowledge and learn more in just 15 minutes than you can in almost any other way. Plus, you can listen anytime, anywhere. I personally like to listen to Blinkist while I'm actually at work because my current job is mindless, so Blinkist is perfect. Anytime, think about working out, driving to the office. A lot of people have long drive times. Blinkist is perfect for those that have a lot of downtime The Blinkist library is massive.
From timeless classics like Freakonomics, which would certainly resonate with listeners of this podcast, to current Amazon's bestsellers like The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. My personal recommendation is to check out How to Win Friends and Influence People, of course, a classic. Also, The Botany of Desire by Michael Pollan is on there too. It'll reshape the way you look at food and particularly produce retail. Quite interesting. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/retail to start your free 7-day trial. You can cancel at any time. Blinkist.com/retail. And now a large 2-in-1 story for us as Mattress Firm filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy late last week. We knew it was coming. The very rumor of the filing was a Looking Ahead segment not that long ago where we briefly discussed the real estate implications. All the potential real estate openings should Mattress Firm file bankruptcy and exit certain markets. But another company in trouble we'll talk about today is Barnes & Noble. They're apparently looking to sell themselves in an attempt to rebound from poor management. First, Mattress Firm, though. Mattress Firm is considered one of the largest bedding retailers in the U.S. South African firm Steinhoff International Holdings bought Mattress Firm in 2016 for $3.8 billion with cash and stock. It's one of the first stories we covered, actually, on the Retail Focus podcast. This represented a 115% premium over the trading price of the stock at the time. This delighted shareholders, but a lot of analysts were worried, and our eyebrows were arched, seeing not a clear way forward for such a premium over the share price. A lot of people thought they overpaid. Well, after many rumors, Mattress Firm officially filed for bankruptcy on Friday. The company is known for its massive presence throughout the U.S. in nearly every class of shopping center. They have a lot of standalone properties adjacent to shopping centers as well. And it is that very presence that has spelled doom for the mattress retailer, as many, including ourselves, thought they were overextended in terms of footprint, a few too many locations and a few too many stretched out shopping centers. Anecdotally, mattress retailers never seem to have much foot traffic to begin with. It's not as though people are flocking into the door because mattresses are an as-needed item. Their model, though, is predicated on large margins and relatively low payroll because you only have 1 to 2 staff per store at any given time. Now, the lease rates are particularly high in many of the areas where they do business, which is what this story is mostly about. Looking at their current portfolio of stores, it's almost as though they paid little to no attention about the lease rates whatsoever and little to no attention about trying to move into smaller footprint locations when they knew foot traffic could be on the lighter side for some of their stores.
Talking about mattresses makes me think back to the last time I bought a mattress and where. It was actually at a mattress firm, but that mattress firm is no longer open, so it's fairly interesting. But I probably will be in the market fairly soon because the mattress I'm sleeping on is around 8 years old, and they say around 10 to 12 years, you need to be getting a new mattress. So it's probably about time that I start shopping around, and I probably will be going to a mattress firm or another brick and mortar location where I actually can lay on the mattress before I decide to buy. But with this bankruptcy, with this mattress firm bankruptcy, they can now exit hundreds of those leases without having to pay the exorbitant fees for leaving prematurely. And this is something we've talked about with a lot of retailers in conventional indoor malls. They want to leave, but are hamstrung because they have to pay such a large balloon payment because they're leaving prematurely. They may have 2 or 3 years left, but they want to leave now, so that's going to cost them, and it usually costs them the remainder of the lease, so they might as well just stay if the store is profitable or if they're at least at break-even status. And looking at Mattress Firm's entire store portfolio, we can see that they operate a network of nearly 3,400 stores throughout the United States. So think of the amount of stores that is, and think of it as they are not a conventional retailer. Mattress stores, they just have inventory set up so that people can come in and try on the mattress or lay on the mattress and see if they like it. But overall, this is fairly burdensome because you need a lot of square footage in order to house the mattresses and to make sure that people are given enough options when they're trying out the different mattresses. So for now, the plan is to close around 5.8% of their current store base. So if you do the quick math there, so around 200 stores in the next month or two, with another 500 by the end of the year. And this is the first week of October. So think about by the end of December, they could have a total of 500 stores closed of their 3,400 in the United States. This is undoubtedly going to hurt some of the owners of the properties in which they are currently in, some of which are the REITs that we have covered on this very podcast. Despite larger market criticisms of having too much retail square footage in the U.S. overall, you think of these large companies who a lot of people say they don't need 10,000 or 100,000 square feet to do business. Occupancy rates, despite all of that rhetoric, have been very strong and have been strong for a long time now, stronger than office supply in the United States. And landlords have actually been able to extract rent increases in the Class A and Class B shopping centers. So overall, the conventional indoor malls have seen some problems and have been cutting deals routinely with tenants to keep them in place, but shopping centers are pretty healthy. This is actually going to put a dent in many of those larger locations throughout the United States where Mattress Firm does business. And you look at why, in terms of why Mattress Firm is filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy, it is not all about retail and being over-retailed, having too many locations in terms of their real estate portfolio. One headline from CNN read, "How Casper drove Mattress Firm into bankruptcy." And while the e-commerce only mattress environment has certainly eroded brick and mortar market share, it would be false to identify this as the main factor or the main culprit. May we remind CNN of Casper's plans to roll out more pop-up shops and conventional stores in shopping centers in the coming years. We recently covered Casper's management and their belief that having a brick and mortar presence in the mattress business will absolutely be crucial to keeping a strong brand and really spreading out awareness for their customer base. Casper wants to, by the way, open 200 locations in the next 3 to 4 years. Mattress Firm has a strong brand, obviously, and what they've actually failed to do, in our opinion, is use that brand on a more robust digital platform. It wasn't necessarily needing to change completely, but rather allocating some of the capital they've used to grow their brick and mortar presence in order to grow their e-commerce platform and have a little bit more optionality, just like Casper has. After having bought the mattress chain Sleepy's in 2015, it became apparent that their store base was far too large. And this is something that a lot of people point to because Sleepy's, they had a lot of stores close to the already in business Mattress Firm locations. And so when they rebranded, you would sometimes see a Mattress Firm just across the street from another Mattress Firm. So even in their Chapter 11 filing, they said that just having too many locations that were too close in proximity to one another was a main reason. Another piece of Mattress Firm's business that is being misrepresented, we feel, in the mainstream media is their price point relative to the up-and-coming competition. Their prices were actually always fair. At least when I shopped at Mattress Firm, it was very fair. And if you compare the prices to Casper, it's not too far off. The value of the service is what's being discounted here, because Casper is offering to send you the mattress, try it out, and if you don't like it, they'll ship it back for free. That's the value there, not the necessary price point in which everybody is looking at. And I think people are looking at that a little too intently, saying that that's the reason. They're not a bargain play. They're not a value play. They're actually right in line with a lot of their competitors in terms of that upfront price point. And again, it was not as if Mattress Firm didn't deliver for free. I had my mattress delivered for free, and they still have similar programs out there for their other locations. Many think that Mattress Firm will actually have a tough time being able to rebound from this. One thing is for sure, though, Trent, their balance sheet will be cleaned up, at least in the near term.
In a statement, their CEO, Steve Stagner, said that they will be allowed to strengthen their balance sheet as a result of getting out of some of these leases and closing some of these stores, and accelerate optimization of their store portfolio. Another word for just cleaning up their store portfolio and closing some stores. Now, this tells us very little about their plans and strategy going forward. Even Toys R Us did a better job at identifying plans to accelerate their online business after their initial bankruptcy filing and announcement of store closings. Granted, didn't work out for them. Time will tell if Mattress Firm bounces back, but I think that there is a lot of negativity, and justifiably so, surrounding Mattress Firm. Now let's move into a different segment in Barnes & Noble. Shares of the publicly traded company have been falling steadily since 2015. While they're viewed as a predominantly brick-and-mortar retailer, they do have a strong e-commerce presence. I actually just bought something on their website a couple of weeks ago. However, generally, they have still not evolved as much as needed over the last few years, and management has been slow to react with initiatives to drive traffic. We had a guest on about 6 months ago on the podcast discussing Barnes & Noble's push towards getting bigger and better eateries in their stores, ones that cater to millennials, so to speak. And we even talked during that interview about their plans to do a few of those, but they didn't have any long-term plans with those particular restaurants. Now, we should say the one upside generally with Barnes & Noble is that their stores are not in as many aging conventional malls as some of the other notable retailers that are struggling. They do have a presence in many of the nicer shopping centers, a lot of Class A shopping centers throughout the U.S., some Class Bs as well. The company operates a total of 629 Barnes & Noble bookstores in 50 states, and also one of the web's largest bookselling websites in just BN.com. Just last month, Barnes & Noble released their fiscal first quarter earnings, and the results were fairly soft, as one could imagine. They've been pretty routinely soft over the last 3 to 4 years. Total sales for the first quarter were $795 million, and they declined 6.9% as compared to the prior year, with comp store sales declining 6.1%. And we've talked in this retail climate, if you're not showing positive numbers, you're in trouble. If you're showing negative numbers, this badly negative, you're in serious trouble. Now, same store sales reportedly did improve each month throughout the quarter, but all of the declines were still over 4%. This is a lot like a Sears Holdings type of improvement where you're losing still, but just not by as much as what you were. The consolidated first quarter net loss was $17.0 million or 23 cents per share as compared to a loss of $10.8 million or 15 cents per share in the prior year. And so these recent lows have sent the company's market cap to below $400 million, leading some to believe that they could be bought before having to potentially shutter stores. $400 million, you figure a potentially slight increase over that price would be what it would take to get the deal done. We don't know if shareholders would approve at that price, but again, this has started up a lot of rumors, as it does anytime a retailer's market cap begins to shrink like this. And Leighton, as of last Wednesday, the company is officially looking for strategic alternatives in order to satisfy the interest of multiple parties, most notably the shareholders.
Seems as though everybody was happy on the news, because really the underpinnings of it was that there are rumors that there are multiple parties that are interested in buying Barnes & Noble. So if you're a longtime shareholder, you're like, oh my gosh, thank goodness, because we've been waiting and looking at our shares really depreciate in value over time. Because of this news, Trent, Barnes & Noble, ticker BKS, those shares skyrocketed 27% immediately after the news. So we talk about a market cap that was hovering around $398 million, like you had mentioned. Not anymore. It's well above $500 million now because of this news. The board has actually put together a special committee to review the best options to take the company forward. According to a formal press release on Barnes & Noble's investor relations page, they have close to a year, an entire year, to evaluate all of their options. There is an expiration period in the search for strategic alternatives, and that's going to be in October of 2019. So it's almost exactly a year, around 51 weeks. The retailer said in a statement that it has received expressions of interest from multiple parties, including its chairman, Leonard Riggio, who actually founded Barnes & Noble in 1965. And you look at Riggio, he's been credited for creating the recreational bookstore concept, because back before, a lot of people don't remember, 20, 30, 40 years ago, before even when we were born, bookstores weren't how they are now. They were more private. They were smaller. They weren't as customer facing as they are now, with coffee shops and in-store beverage offerings. Well, he helped transform their concept. Fundamentally, he did. And he managed the IPO as well in 1993. And he was actually CEO until 2010. So imagine between 1965 and 2010, how many changes he brought forth and really helped retail in general. And now the company not looking so good. The last decade has proved to be troublesome for Riggio because of his executive teams. After he stepped down in 2010, there's been no CEO that has them on a firm track for success. And this is sort of a perfect storm because of the retailing landscape. But Riggio may feel as though taking the company private himself may be more beneficial to those that are going to stay with the company into the future, at least make it a sustainable company, even though they may have to downsize a bit. Within the special committee, there is an interesting dynamic because Riggio is the one to oversee the entire process. He would basically be negotiating with himself if they decide to take Riggio's offer. And to a point, this is interesting because he does have the last say for the special committee's findings and official recommendation. So All of the special advisors to the committee have yet to be named, but it should, in theory, be for all of the shareholders, not just Regio. It should be looking out for the best interests of all of the stakeholders. Regio, by the way, owns 19% of Barnes & Noble still, their largest shareholder. So while everybody has an interest who has ownership in the shares, he has the biggest one. And this is according to FactSet. He is, by the way, 77 years of age. So you do have to think, is he going to actually manage the company, or does he just want to take it private? And does he have a leadership team in mind to make it a successful company and profitable yet again? In the meantime, their year-ending report gave some hope that the fiscal 2019 period would be relatively strong. Again, they just last month released their first quarter earnings, so we have three more quarters to go. Through outlined cost reductions and marketing efforts used to boost sales, they do anticipate earnings before depreciation and taxes and interest to come in around $175 to $200 million by fiscal year's end. Again, this is EBITDA. This isn't the actual true net income number. However, a lot of people were saying that this is a good sign for the company if they were able to actually bear out these numbers. A Barron's analyst did note that most retailers are actually valued at 10 times EBITDA. And if we look at some of their current market cap numbers, we could see that they are less than a third of the value of then an average competitor using that EBITDA multiple. So one good thing that you could say is that if the profit projections come true, then this is actually a good value play for those interested in buying this retailer. And overall, you look at another activist investor, Rick Schadenfield. He says that despite having a 6.9% stake in Barnes & Noble, he says that the company can increase profits by creating more of a town square feel, more of a town square atmosphere, and differentiate even further in its physical store footprint than the other bookstores that are popping up. He went on to say that a financial buyer should value the stock around $8 to $10 a share, or if it's a strategic buyer, and by this I believe he means someone like Amazon or another retail player that can actually add value, an add value play, this has inherent value that can be brought into the company, and they should be paying around $12 a share. So right now, Trent, shares are hovering around $7 as of recording this podcast this Monday. We look back last week, shares were up in the high $6 range. You know, there's still a lot of momentum around this news. So the $510 million market cap that they currently have, you could see that escalate if, in fact, this activist investor and all of the other analysts that are pretty positive about this news are correct in that somebody could come in, despite their levels of debt, despite the current lease rates in some of these newer shopping centers, could come in and add true value to Barnes & Noble. Because, you know, despite the negativity surrounding book retail, there is still a lot of money, a lot of brand equity in the Barnes & Noble name.
I got this phone call about 5:30, 6 a.m., was tasked with devising a go-to-market strategy for a rebrand. We knew that we had resonated with those hikers or those surfers or skiers, but we needed to expand our reach and make sure that these people were able to go from the boardroom to the board with our sunglasses. AdRoll was definitely instrumental in getting this new brand out there, both from a prospecting and remarketing standpoint, and they kind of helped me break down how the funnel looked and how we wanted to position our messaging. I was getting slacks from everyone in the company when they'd see an ad somewhere, like in the New York Times. Everyone was super stoked to see our new content and our new brand creative out there. You know, they definitely helped me shine internally at Sunski from a marketing standpoint.
To find out how Sunski and 37,000 other brands grow their businesses with AdRoll, visit adroll.com/retail. That's adroll.com/retail.
Well, our final story in this Retail Focus podcast, we focus on Stitch Fix. Now, Stitch Fix made the reaction to Costco's quarter look like the best of all time as subscriber numbers missed analyst estimates and caused the stock to topple nearly 34%. We should preface this by saying that, honestly, their earnings report wasn't as bad as that 34% drop made it seem, and actually, they reported some positive numbers that we were quite impressed by, including the fact that they're profitable, despite the fact that you don't see many e-commerce startups be this profitable. Stitch Fix reported on Monday of last week and showed inherent weakness in their business model despite putting up double-digit revenue gains. Now, some of this weakness, like I said, it should be tempered, be taken with a grain of salt because expectations are so high. But the 34% drop we talk about included the 20% drop that shares experienced during after-hours trading after the formal release. You see this a lot in the first year after a company's IPO. Stocks will bump and fall wildly based on quarterly results. And the results here, like with Costco, were for their fourth quarter. Now, for those that don't know, Stitch Fix is an online shopping service that sends men's and women's clothing to customers' homes, allowing you to send back what you don't want with free shipping and returns. They were founded back in 2011, IPO just last year. As far as competition in the space, there is a lot. Trunk Club, which we've talked about, dragging Nordstrom's results down several times. Trendy Butler, among many others. Bombfell is another that's in that same category. During their IPO, Stitch Fix raised $120 million. The initial share price debut on NASDAQ was $16.90, which was actually below their initial target range, but shares fell on the first day of trading that they hit NASDAQ as well. Earnings for their latest quarter, which ended July 28th, came in at $18.3 million, or 18 cents per share. This beat expectations by 4 cents, and once again, I'm going to say it one more time, this is earnings. This is not a loss like what we've seen with so many other e-commerce retailers, even the likes of Wayfair, which you think is an e-commerce giant, they're still struggling to make a profit quarter after quarter. For Stitch Fix, their gross margin was 44.4%. That's the highest in all of fiscal 2018, so it beat their prior three quarters in fiscal 2018, and it was better than last year's fourth quarter. SG&A improved 140 basis points over last year as they have farmed less workout and they have less costs around facility maintenance now. And by the way, they employ 180 engineers and 100 data scientists. So they've got a lot of people behind the scenes making things work. And it's a big reason why revenue grew 23% to $318 million, even if analysts did expect close to a million more in sales.
Revenue, as most anyone would guess, is a function of average membership on its subscription model. Also obvious is the correlation between quarterly income and how frequently customers request their packages. So it is dependent on the intervals in which customers sign up. They can sign up for packages every month, every quarter, every half year. So it is really in the consumer's hands. However, it is subscription-based, so you do have to stay in for at least some sort of interval. And finance-wise, Trent, it is easy to get behind this company because they have no debt. And this is exactly the position of Stitch Fix and what they've been wanting to achieve on their balance sheet. They have roughly $300 million in cash. Again, no debt. And this reminds me of Groupon. A few years ago, Groupon was saying, why is our share price going down? Why are people so negative? We have no debt. Well, you're not growing. But with Stitch Fix, they are growing. So we do have to scratch our heads a little bit. The number of clients grew by about the same pace as total revenue, which is pretty good. This means that the new customers that are onboarding are paying as much as the other average customers. But still, overall, well below what analysts were looking for. The company, having reported 2.7 million active clients, again, they call their customers clients because this is sort of a design and styling business, but this is versus the 2.81 million clients that were expected from analysts. The company is based out of the United States, out of San Francisco, good old Silicon Valley, really supplying them their engineers. And this has been showing a dedication to the domestic marketplace. They said that the US is their bread and butter. This is the market that they know. And again, as Trent noted earlier, they've only been established since 2011. So it's smart of them to really focus in the United States. However, this deceleration of growth, or at least slower than anticipated growth from analysts, may be a big reason for the big headlines that we saw this week, where they're going to try to increase their subscriber base by going into the UK. And this is sort of a jump, again, from their prior methodology of staying in the United States for the longer term. It's not as though they're losing sight of their US business, but they are headed into the UK with a full head of steam. They're saying that early 2019, they're going to be in full business. And they cited their personalized shopping experience as being a good differentiated factor. But they also believe that their experience in the space is going to be very important for them in order to showcase growth to investors. And this really gives them the reason and the comfort to make the European foray because they have been doing this for some time. However, we would argue that the European market, the UK market, is going to be different. However, management said that basically it is a less risky market. And this is why this is going to be their first international market, because of their e-commerce growth over the past half decade in the UK. There's actually already competitors set up that have been doing it and have proved out the concept. So when they come in, they're just going to be another competitor. It's not like it's going to be how it was 7-8 years ago in the United States, where these subscription models were first coming online and they really had to go through an education process with the common consumer to try to explain what the annual membership fees are, what the services are that they're going to be providing, how it's going to be differentiated as far as the styling offerings. They don't have to do that legwork in the UK. So we also have to point out that growth in the US isn't going to stagnate because of differentiated offerings with plus size and children's offerings. They feel as though that they can actually use those niche markets to attract more sales from the consumers that have already been using the Stitch Fix platform. So for instance, if you're a family of four, you can now buy your children clothes on the platform. In addition to missing sales expectations for the latest quarter, the company came in light on their first quarter predictions. And while this may reflect a bit of sandbagging for the company, founder and CEO Katrina Lake has faith that long-term results will pan out for the company, thanks in part to the Stitch Fix Kids and Stitch Fix UK division. Lake went on to remind those listening on the earnings call that revenue marks for the fourth quarter were within guidance and that earnings per share numbers did in fact demonstrate that the company has disciplined acceleration of new business. This echoes the statements made during the very first earnings call last December when they first became a publicly traded company, when they said to expect sales to rise, but in a responsible manner, basically saying that they aren't looking to erode profitability and grow too fast now that they have the extra capital to do so.
Now, Lake's confidence on the call stems from the platform, which she says has transformed how people find the clothes they love. The business model, as alluded to earlier, is essentially the same as it was 7 years ago, wherein user confidence comes by way of curating the right trendy outfits for customers. If they do a good job, customers will be repeat customers, or clients will be repeat clients. And we all know that repeat customers are the most valuable. Layton talks about this on a constant basis, week in, week out. They're looking, Stitch Fix is, to take the basic rules of retailing, only to take on an expanding assortment for current customers. So those current customers, they're trying to expand out their offerings just a little bit. In addition, they look to spend some of their cash on growing their addressable market. Their Style Pass membership, for example, it was rolled out in December of 2017, has grown over 60% in terms of enrollment. What that is users pay $49 per year, and this fee basically eliminates the normal $20 styling fee from each fix. They have found that customers typically engage more with the platform and have more frequent ordering intervals when they're Style Pass members. So just like with other loyalty programs, they see a boost when people jump on. As for expanding the addressable market, they feel like that fourth quarter expansion into kids apparel basically guarantees them at least some sales from existing customers who have kids. They want to get the entire household on board, men, women, children, all across the board. And with this, this gives them that ability for the first time. They also reassured analysts that they were seeing positive and strong interest from existing clients. Early signs with the rollout, also generally positive. In our view, this rollout was inevitable. However, it does get them into a new realm in their business, and that it will most likely be the parents choosing styles, not the kids, making this a more conventional transaction where the end user doesn't really get a personalized experience because you've got that medium there of the parents. You've got that go-between. Still, though, it's equivalent to the parents going to the store and curate outfits, but maybe with better ideas to choose from. And also, it all generates money for the retailers, regardless of whether that medium is there. The key will be for Stitch Fix keeping the medium happy, and granted, to some extent, the kids. But if you can keep the parents happy, they're going to keep spending that money. In any online subscription model, generally speaking, it's all about looking at the cost of customer acquisition. If you can't show proof of concept, it's going to show up in this figure. And while many companies can get away with the nearly free social media content that they've got and word of mouth, Stitch Fix has been a bit more aggressive in getting their message out there, and it hasn't come at the cost of their bottom line either. Again, they're still making money quarter after quarter, and that's perhaps why they're a near household name in this space, above and beyond others. You know, we saw with meal kits, every company was spending money to get their name out there. And so you had a dilution in the marketplace. That hasn't really taken place with Stitch Fix, in part because of TV ad campaigns. And according to management on the call, these ad campaigns are more beneficial than originally thought. They even did a test where they stopped TV ads to gauge how many customers were coming through the channel, and it showed that there was increased interest on the conventional format when they were running TV ads. They're using some of this data to better divide ad spending between all platforms going forward. They also drove down advertising leverage by a modest 10 basis points, but had better overall conversion, which is just about what everyone wants in terms of spending money on marketing.
And speaking of data there, we are always looking at how a company is continuously improving, and they are doing just that. Those programmers, those data engineers, those data scientists that they have on board that Trent had mentioned, over 280 of them, they're improving their stylist client matching algorithm. So every person is going to want something a little bit different. And so when they go through this process, that is how they differentiate their business model. The person wants to feel comfortable with what they're getting at their doorstep. And honestly, with that free shipping, those free returns, it's extremely costly if they get this wrong. So because of the changes in the algorithms, they have been seeing an increase in the average customer order value. Looking at all of those add-on items, people are buying more, people are more pleased. This does much better for the company's top line and bottom line because, again, they don't have to pay for all of those returns. The more order insights, too, think of this on an exponential scale. The more customers, the more orders, the better they can adjust for future algorithms and see if customer X like product Y and Z, then perhaps the other customer that is extremely similar to customer X will also like Y and Z. Those are horrible analogies, but overall, you can get the idea that data has helped to make operational management a little bit more aware of internal opportunities and efficiencies, which has played an integral part in them getting that 44% gross margin. 44% for a company like this, that is very, very good. Decreases also in their inventory reserves for this fourth quarter, lower clearance expense, and reducing common shrink. So those common shrink problems that affect every retail business, whether it's an e-commerce only business or brick and mortar, they're doing very well efficiently to getting the operations streamlined. Those margins are going to naturally see a little less pressure in the long run as they continue to leverage scale and buying. They mentioned this during the call, particularly in their most sought after categories. Think about this. If more men use the program or more women use the program, and there's more subsets of individuals that like common items, those common items are going to be cheaper for them. So they actually mentioned this with men's selections and how many of the common items are actually coming in a little cheaper because they're able to leverage those economies of scale. Main investment seems to be in with their talent pool, as we alluded to earlier, because capital expenditures represented only 1.4% of revenue for all of 2018. However, they tout this number as being a good one, but if you think about this logically, what do they really need to invest in terms of capital expenditures? They don't need a lot of room for real estate, and their business actually exists through servers and network capacity, but that is actually what this is. This is what they mean when they talk about capital expenditures. They did note a faster inventory turn as well for the quarter, so they don't have to carry as much inventory because they know what their customers are going to be buying because of these better algorithms. So what they are investing more in is warehouse automation, which of course is very important for any retailer in this category. Along with this, they need more space at their headquarters. So this is actually a really good thing for them. Two really good things in terms of longevity for the company. They're looking at ways to increase their talent pool, so they're going to need more space for them to do so. And warehouse automation is going to, in theory, reduce overhead for those hourly workers that they're able to eliminate if they can automate some of the processes in the back room. But shares of Stitch Fix, ticker SFUX, continued to slide this week and really close at a relative low on this last Friday, around $26.30 per share, lows in the low 20s in 2018 until an aggressive run up here not that long ago. They ran up in September when shares hit all-time highs of around $50 per share. Market cap, by the way, for the company is around $2.57 billion, which is about four times that of JCPenney, to put this in perspective. Price-to-earnings ratio is still a lofty one, around 58 times earnings. If you compare that to how the company has fared with this recent downturn in the share price, you could say that the company is still doing fairly well and that maybe there's room to grow on both sides of the equation. So if negative news hits the company, the share price still has room to go downward. And the share price could go upward if they meet their goals for the first quarter of next year.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment we call Looking Ahead, where each Leighton and I keep our eye on one story that we're looking towards for the next week, month, or year. And actually, I've decided to change it up this week. I'm going to go first as we get word by way of Produce Retailer. Hope to have their editor, Ashley Nickel, on the show soon again. But three Price Right Marketplace locations actually have started a new pilot format in grocery stores in the northeastern United States. They're all three in Pennsylvania. By the way, if you're not familiar with Price Right, it's basically a spinoff chain from Wakefern Food Corporation. Wakefern, by the way, owns ShopRite. A lot of people familiar with ShopRite. Well, there's 60-some-odd Price Right stores in the U.S. They are smaller stores. They have fewer SKUs. They're modeled after Trader Joe's and Lidl and Aldi, except without the massive number of private brands. They do have a few more national brands. But the main point to this pilot is they're rolling out a brand new produce selection. I know if you're familiar with an Aldi or a Save-A-Lot food store, sometimes that produce selection gets overlooked, and Price Right trying to turn that model on its head a little bit, also emphasizing organic and gluten-free options with this new store experience. There are actually videos of this on Produce Retailer's website, and it's really interesting how they have the stores set up. It's a lot brighter, a lot more expansive produce selection, produce pushed a lot closer to the front of the store in this circumstance. And this is one facet in Price Right's game to try and win market share away from the likes of an Aldi or a Save-A-Lot. And in fact, one of the interesting things about Price Right is that they use the term American company or American owned a lot in their marketing, referencing, of course, the fact that Lidl and Aldi are German owned or internationally owned at the very least. But I'm anxious to see if this will take off in their other stores. Price Right has expanded massively over the last decade, really popped up, really expanding in the northeastern United States, in Pennsylvania, markets like Maryland as well. Pretty much everywhere in the northeastern United States, except for the extreme northeast United States, now has a Price Right retailer. So I'm looking at this and looking to see how far this pilot will go in terms of Price Right stores. And if this is the model of the Price Right store of the future, and if it is, can Price Right eat away at some of that market share that Aldi has gobbled up in the last few years?
Well, my looking ahead story, I thought I was being clever by mentioning JCPenney during our last story in terms of the market cap of JCPenney and how small it is. That's because I wanted to talk about JCPenney just for a little bit. In my looking ahead story, I'm going to be looking at news that broke middle of last week where Jill Soltau, the former CEO of Joann Fabrics, will actually be taking the helm of the retailer. And this is after, of course, Marvin Ellison departed and took that CEO position over at Lowe's. And honestly, he's received a lot of criticism for just abruptly leaving during the middle of a turnaround for JCPenney. But JCPenney has fallen on hard times, and this is a retailer that I have invested in, and I still own shares, sadly, of the retailer. And they've been struggling this year, and they've been struggling mightily. Last year, they were able to turn a $1 million profit, and overall, all of the statements from their now departed CFO, their CEO at the time, Marvin Ellison, were directing me to think that the company was going to maintain profitability and actually end up paying off a ton of debt. But they haven't done anything, to be honest with you. And overall, their product selection has actually waned. And because of that, those inventory woes that we spoke about over the last two quarters, they continue to exist. So my looking ahead story has to do with Jill Soltau, a very well-regarded CEO, a very well-regarded retail executive, and what she can do, if anything, to turn this company around. And our friends over at The Motley Fool, they were saying this last week that, honestly, they think this is going to be a tough position for her to come in and for a lot of shareholders and analysts to expect something out of the company. Even though they still have some very valuable real estate. They have some very valuable brand equity. It is a tough task, but if you look at the statement of Paul Brown, JCPenney board member and chairman of the CEO search committee, he said that Jill stood out from the entire ranks of those people coming in, an incredibly strong slate of candidates that were coming in that showed interest in taking over the CEO spot at JCPenney. And if you look at her experience, and that is what this story really is about, what can she bring to the table? You look at her experience with Joann Fabrics, but not only that, she actually had a very important role with Shopko. She had roles at Sears in the past, which of course has had their own fair share of troubles, but also worked at Kohl's, which is more in line with what JCPenney does and who they're competing against. So I'm extremely curious if she can use her merchandising expertise to really help JCPenney out, because to be honest with you, that is the problem. In my view, the last 8-9 years for JCPenney has been about slew of different strategies that has really confused their customer base. They don't know if they're a value retailer or a high-end retailer with limited inventory on the floor, and they still have similar problems. And because of that, they have a glut of inventory on their balance sheet and have been unable to pay debt off because people are no longer shopping in their stores. So if she turns that around, then perhaps traffic will follow.
Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus podcast. Once again, a big thanks to you, our listeners, but also our sponsors for this week's episode, Adroll.com and Blinkist. We'll be back next week with more retail news over the weekend.
This has been the Retail Focus podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.